Welcome into the Investing in Real Estate Show. I'm Clayton Morris. So glad to have you here on this channel. I don't want you to buy anything. I don't want you to do anything. I just want you to sit back and learn and become a more intelligent real estate investor. This is our Q&A episode where we take your calls. You can leave us a voicemail message just by going to our website. Go to morrisinvest.com and you'll see on the right side of the screen, there's a little microphone icon there for you to leave us a voicemail. Try to keep it to 30 seconds or less if you could. And ask your questions about real estate or taxes or financial freedom, whatever it happens to be. We try to answer those questions here on the show. We've got three questions for you today, and let's dive into them on this Monday.
Good morning, Clayton. My name is Pratap. I'm trying to find an asset protection attorney. I emailed one of the attorney, and he is very expensive. He said he's going to charge me $29,000 initial fee and then a $2,600 every year. Is that realistic or is there a cheaper ones? Could you please recommend any asset protection attorney? Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Pratap. This is a good question. And I don't, to be honest with you, I don't recall what we spent a number of years ago for setting up our asset protection process. In the United States, it can be fairly cumbersome. But if you want to protect your assets, of course, right? You want to cover your own assets, as it were. Very, very important. And this is not something that you necessarily have to worry about at the very beginning. I mean, with a few properties, then that's when you want to start thinking about long term. But in the beginning, if you don't have a lot of properties or you don't have any, thinking about at least consulting with an asset protection attorney about proper structure. Because let me just tell you, it was more expensive for Natalie and I to unwind the mistakes we made by setting up things kind of hodgepodge at the beginning. If we knew we had the roadmap in front of us, we could have set it up much more cleanly and easily. So again, I don't know how much it cost. I do know that it was a little pricey. I don't know that it was that expensive, what the price that you mentioned. We worked with a great team out of Utah. They're fantastic. In fact, Andrew Howell wrote the book called Entrusted. I would encourage all of you to read that book. That's how we learned about them. They came highly recommended to us. An amazing attorney team, York, Hal, and Goyman out of Utah, out of South Jordan, Utah. It's a team that works at York, Hal, and Goyman. We'll have a link in the description. And again, I don't know which team that you've worked with, but they will take you through that process of structuring and making sure that your properties are reporting properly to an LLC or a holding company. That holding company wants to be in a business-friendly state. And then that state, that holding company is going to report up. There's going to be a whole ladder sequence that's going to go through. But more importantly, they wanted to understand, in the case of one of us passes away, how does the estate get handed to our children? What are the stipulations and things that are going to be put in place for your children to be able to be able to spend certain money at certain times in their lives? And all of these things go into this planning session. So it's not as simple as, okay, what LLC talks to what LLC and on up to a trust, a land trust, or whatever it happens to be, whatever structure they find is useful for you, but really is about understanding your family. In the event that one of you passes away, well, do you want your sister-in-law to handle the process for you? Do you want them to be able to take care of your kids? Or these are really serious questions that you need to be having with a tax attorney who's going to earn an estate attorney who's going to be planning all of this out. Because, I'm sure we've all seen, it was the Rockefeller's show. I can't remember the show that was, I watched it a few years ago, really, really good. And you realize, I think it was Rockefeller's. I can't remember. Anyway, the kids in the family, like some of them were just total degenerates, And so these are questions. I mean, I hate to put that out there, but there's going to be kids and there's going to be part members of your family who are more able to handle maybe the people in the family if something were to happen to you. And then there's going to be people that are better hand suited to handling the money in your family. And all of those questions come up during this planning session. I remember the planning sessions for us took a couple of hours over multiple phone calls going through the details. And once we ended up getting and putting our entire estate together, I mean, it looked like a phone book. I mean, it was thick. So most people don't do this. And I, you know, shop around, yes, look for different attorneys, but this is your life we're talking about here, right? And of course, at the end of the day, it is also a business expense working with attorneys. So you need to think of it in terms of a business expense for your business and your family's estate. So again, I don't know the price tag. It's been a few years. It's been a number of years since we set ours up. But that's one that I highly recommend you check out is the team over at York, Hall & Goyman. Tell them that we sent you. They are good friends of our family, and they've just done an amazing job for us. So that is one way, one place I would look. I wish I had more details on that. And I know the price tag is a little scary. You know, it's not going to be $200. You know, it's not going to be like Better Call Saul. Can you plan my life and make sure that all of my assets are protected? Sure, I'll get you. You know, you're not going to see a billboard on the side of the road and be able to hire one of those attorneys. That's not who you want in this situation. All right, our next question comes to us from Vincent.
What are the best ways for forced appreciation on a single family home? And what are examples of over rehabbing a property? Thank you.
Thank you, Vincent. So forced appreciation of a home. This is a great question. You hear it a lot in commercial properties. So it's interesting that Vincent is asking for this as it relates to residential property. Forced appreciation. Let's differentiate, right? Market appreciation, natural appreciation is what happens for supply and demand, right? We are in a market right now where there's incredible demand for property. We just have an absolute shortage of properties in the United States. We're 20 million units short, and that's not going to change 5-10 years from now. It's going to still be the case. It's going to take a long time for us to be caught up with the demand for the supply and demand. So appreciation simply is, you know, these properties are appreciating because the market is demanding it. And so the prices are going up in different markets. Now, personally, I don't like to invest in markets with crazy appreciation. I tend to see those as kind of bubble markets, you know, San Francisco, Vegas, Miami, New York, those types of places. I don't invest in those areas. The areas I like to invest in have nice appreciation, but they're kind of boring appreciation. And I look at appreciation as sort of icing on the investing cake, if you will. I don't invest for appreciation, but it's nice. It's nice because if I want to pull some equity out of that property at some point, great. But at the end of the day, it's nice icing on the cake. It's not why I invest. I invest for cash flow and asset protection. Legacy wealth protection and making sure that my money is in a tangible asset rather than US dollars, et cetera. So appreciation just kind of comes with market conditions. Now, forced appreciation, what Vincent is asking about is where you're trying to change the value of that property through some manipulative ways. And it's not necessarily bad or evil or anything like that. It's just that you are trying to force it rather than the market conditions. And one way, the biggest way of all to do that is to raise rent, forcing the appreciation of your property, raising the rent of the property. And that can be tricky. You want to make sure that it's commensurate. In my opinion, you want to make it sure that it's commensurate with market conditions, because now suddenly, you know, if your property is $200 more per month than the rest of the street or the rest of the neighborhood, well, you know, does yours stand out for some particular reason? You know, does yours have a pool, or is there some reason that you're charging $200 more than the same house, the same square footage in that neighborhood for no real reason? So that's one way, is forced appreciation. But this is where I want to be speaking with my property manager and looking at, hey, now that that tenant has moved out, can we raise rent for the next tenant because market conditions warrant us raising the rent $50 to $100 or $200, whatever it happens to be in that particular community? That's one way of doing it. Other forced appreciation ways can be trying to make grand improvements to the property. Again, this normally comes from things outside, like a park or things like you're creating at a commercial space. So forced appreciation. So if you look at the value of a property, like a 100-unit or 50-unit apartment complex, how can you add value to that property that may not already have been added to that property? And therefore, forcing the rents to be higher, just the overall standard of the property to be higher, adding a pool, creating a community space where moms and dads can, with a stroller, walk their kids in a park that's outside of the apartment. That was the case in New York City. Sometimes you'd have a green space that was created in the courtyard or something like that. Maybe a playground, or, like I said, a pool, a community pool. or just making upgrades inside the property are also ways to kind of increase the value, but also increase rents. So you're, you know, that's also a capital investment on your part to put money into these apartments to raise rent that way and push the rent up because you're making improvements to the property. You're making improvements to adding in granite countertops. You're putting in cabinets that are upgraded. You're putting in stainless steel appliances, all those type. Maybe you're putting in an alarm system, other things. You asked another question, Vincent, which is about over upgrading a property. When is it too much? When have you done too much? And again, this is very important to be having those conversations with your property managers because they're going to know the other types of properties in that neighborhood, in that school district, and what is demanded for rent. And they're going to tell you by looking at it when they do a walkthrough of the property, hey, Vincent, we think that you could probably get another $200 per month in rent if you provided, you know, these types of appliances in the property. You placed a new stove or those types of things, or you upgraded the bathroom or something. But very often, a lot of the times, people think that just making certain upgrades is going to increase the rent. Every few years, I look at these lists that are published where they catalog the things that will add real value to your property and the things that won't. And these things fluctuate from time to time. Over the past few years, I mean, one big improvement for the property is a garage door. I know this may not sound like the most, you know, the biggest home improvement, but really making a beautiful garage door aesthetically on the outside of the property, one of those really nice barn door style garage doors with the really nice slatted wood look can really increase the property value. I know it sounds strange, but sure enough, the data is in on that. In really taking care of the outside of the property, the aesthetic value of the outside of the property from maybe new sod, new landscaping, make sure trees are cut back. That can actually really add a nice pop to your property. Areas where I think people over upgrade sometimes can be in the kitchen. They go crazy on things that don't necessarily fit the way a homeowner or a tenant would want. They do some kind of crazy cabinet collection that's the color is really in their interest, but not in the tenant's interest. So maybe trying to stay way more neutral in your cabinet choices. People sometimes put in like a dark wood and really just doesn't fit. And that color can really be off-putting to someone. They walk into that kitchen and they say, this just isn't me. This isn't for me. And great that you spent $10,000 on it, but this doesn't work for me. And that can be like the thing that flips somebody on that. Over upgrading the bathrooms as well, doing all sorts of improvements and things in a shower that don't need to be done, all kinds of additional shower head and faucets that are spraying out all over the place. I've seen people waste a lot of money on those types of upgrades or putting in jacuzzi tubs and things like this that break a lot and are just not needed. That's just not what a tenant is looking for. Tenants are looking for space, okay? They're looking for value. And you as a landlord also need to be thinking about durability too. So putting in things that are going to be constantly breaking, not a smart move. And also, you know, right now, solar panels, still expensive. And I hear from people that say, I'm going to put solar panels on my rental property because that'll really attract a tenant. Sorry, it doesn't. It doesn't. Tenants really aren't looking for that. And so you're going to be spending a lot of money putting solar panels on a roof because you want to be more sustainable. And good for you. If that's something that you want to do personally, good for you. But at the end of the day, it's not something that a tenant is going to jump on and be super excited about. That is absolutely the case. So thank you for that question, Vincent. Good question on forced appreciation. You know, it's no secret that the United States has a healthcare crisis. I mean, 30 million Americans choose to go uninsured and they take their chances. And Republicans and Democrats both don't care at all about changing this system because they profit from it. You know, if you're uninsured right now, I get it. Even with insurance, healthcare costs are out of control. And there's nothing stopping insurance companies and hospitals from continuing to raise prices. But thanks to today's sponsor, CrowdHealth, you don't have to choose between rolling the dice or paying through the nose for some peace of mind. And here's the key. CrowdHealth isn't health insurance. That's actually why it works. Because with insurance, you end up paying huge premiums for high deductibles, which means on top of the thousands you pay to keep your plan, you end up paying thousands more before insurance kicks in one penny. 1 in 6 claimants are denied by healthcare.gov plans. No wonder so many people choose to take their chances without insurance. CrowdHealth gives you a new way to pay for healthcare. No doctor's networks, no huge premiums, no high deductibles, no surprises. Now, you pay one monthly low amount, you fund your account, and you get access to Crowd Health's community. It's less than $200 a month for most people. 100% of your monthly contribution directly funds and reduces the healthcare costs of the community. So that's why really Crowd Health is putting the word community back in community healthcare, and it gives its members access to high quality care for up to 60% less in the process. Now, unlike insurance, Crowd Health succeeds by keeping its members happy, not by driving up the prices. Now, right now, there's a better way to pay for healthcare. Join the crowd. You can get your first 6 months for just $99 per month. That's almost 50% off their normal price and a lot less than a high deductible healthcare plan. Just go to joincrowdhealth.com. Again, you put that join in the front of the URL. It's joincrowdhealth.com. Use the promo code investing when you're signing up. Again, that's joincrowdhealth.com. Use the promo code investing. Crowd Health is not health insurance. It's a totally different way of paying for healthcare. Terms and conditions apply. Our next question comes to us from Mike.
There is some data to suggest that the population is actually starting to decline. That will cause a reduction in demand for real estate. How can we address that issue?
Well, population decline. Thank you, Mike. How do we tackle population decline is a whole other animal from that I know how to handle than from real estate side of things. I mean, but if you're concerned about population decline from a real estate investor perspective, I think that that's many years off from us worrying about that from an investment standpoint. Again, I think there are things that as you're getting started as a real estate investor that people tend to look at and they tend to think, oh my God, yeah, is this in an area where meteors hit on a regular basis? Or is this in an area where volcanoes are prone to explode? You know, if you're just starting out in real estate investing, these are things that are not a huge concern. We still have an enormous, enormous lack of supply. We have an enormous dearth of properties. What's the best way to say that? We have a dearth of properties. We just don't have enough properties to help the amount of people that need to live in a place. And so there is no shortage of lines waiting to get into a property right now. I mean, the lines for new construction properties for tenants is long. Tenants want to move in. Tenants want a new place to live. And because, yes, we're seeing a population decline in the United States for the first time in a long time, Italy is seeing this. Spain is seeing this. Italy, frankly, is giving away like Italian villas for people to come back, move back, because they have such a big population decline there, you know, in aging population. So Japan, particularly, a huge problem there. And so there are incentives that the government can make to try to encourage, you know, expatriates to come back to the mainland, things like that. Hey, all you young Italians out there that are now living in the United States or whatever, come back to Italy and we'll give you a villa, you know, we'll for €1, but you have to live in it. You have to live in it. That's the condition, you know, and we'll even give you some money to fix it up. So there are things that a government can do. And certainly the United States, if it becomes that big of an issue, the United States can absolutely take care of those things. They could cut this war budget, for instance, you know, instead of $760 billion a year for defense contracts to set up bases around the world and to bomb countries indiscriminately, the United States could, in fact, take some of that money and reinvest it into some of those programs to try to get more people to procreate, I guess, in the United States. I mean, honestly, if you look at this data, and I have, one of the big reasons is that families simply can't afford it. They can't afford to have kids. Healthcare is a big reason. So if the United States really wanted to tackle this issue, making America more safe, making America more affordable, maybe would incentivize families to want to have children. So just some ideas there. And also maybe trying to eliminate or find a way to eliminate massive student loans for kids. It's just not an attractive place to want to raise children at this point. I mean, I can understand why they're seeing a population decline. in the United States. All of these factors are leading to that decline. And life expectancy in the United States is also dropping as well. So not a good combination, but also not something to be worried about, like that this is a massive drain on real estate investing. It's going to be a major problem for real estate investing anytime soon. Again, there's still incredible demand for properties, and we still have a massive, massive shortage. So that shortage is not being, you know, eclipsed by this population decline by any stretch of the imagination. So thank you, Mike, for that question. Not something to worry about, especially if you're just getting started in real estate investing. Do not worry about that. There are plenty of other things that, that, you know, are maybe in your way right now that you need to focus on, like getting financing, making sure your credit's okay, lining up down payment amounts, getting all of that stuff in order. That's maybe things you need to focus on, not United States population decline. But I get it. It's still a factor. It's still in there, just not one that I'm worried about. So thank you, Mike, for that question. Thank you to all of our great questions today. Really got me thinking on a whole different bunch of different levels. And sorry for kids yelling in the background. If you heard that, I want to get these kids back to school. It's a Sunday as we're recording this. So sorry for kids yelling in the background, but hey, that's what having three kids. I don't have a population decline in my house with three kids. No problem here. Let me tell you that much. If you'd like to leave us a voicemail question about real estate investing or anything that's on your mind, please do so by going to our website. Go to morrisinvest.com and click on the voicemail button right there. And we also have tons of great information on that website. I'd love for you to download our free, totally free freedom cheat sheet. Again, it's about 3-4 pages. It's a PDF. Again, totally free. You can find that on our website as well to help you on this road to financial freedom. It's morrisinvest.com/freedom. So go grab that cheat sheet today. We'll see you back here next time. Now go out there, take action, become a real estate investor. I believe it's the number one way to build wealth. We'll see you next time, everyone.